I'm Judy Conrad, and I'm an alcoholic. And since I have complete control of my mind, this is such an intimidating group of people. I'm going to be real delusional tonight. Y'all all have 30 days, and I'll give you a chip when I get out from here. Thank you so much for inviting me and having me here tonight. And I'm also, well, I shouldn't say I'm grateful. My husband's not feeling well, so he couldn't be here tonight. So if he wants to rebut, he'll have to get a CD. He promised me he was going to sit in the back and hold up grade cards while I talked. I have been an active, participating member of Alcoholics Anonymous since April the 5th, 1975. And for that, I'm so extremely grateful to even be alive today. And I also qualify that active and participating because I don't think you can come sit in a meeting and drink coffee and get sobriety. I think it takes more than that. At least it did for me. I was raised in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I was one of four girls. Raised Catholic, went to a Catholic school for 12 years. Can't say I was the greatest of students. I think I gave my parents a little bit of problem. I don't remember doing a lot of drinking in high school. I know I did some, but I honestly can't tell you that I remember doing a whole lot of drinking when I was in high school. Back in my day, God, I sound so ancient, I love this. But I did what women of my generation did. You know, I graduated from high school, and I enrolled in LSU, and I majored in engagement rings. And I graduated the first semester. Did very well. But that's what we did. That was your job. You know, you get married and have kids. But I broke that engagement. I mean, he was a really, really nice guy. But he was just too serious, and he just didn't party, and life was pretty dull with him. So that should have been one of my first signs. But at any rate, I wound up marrying the boy across the street from me. His family was always partying, and it made it okay in my mind because the priest partied at their house too. So I did a lot of drinking with the priest, and that qualified a lot of my drinking, and I'm really quite serious about that. I did Bourbon Street a couple of times with the priest, and they party. But at any rate, it's a shame because it almost ruined some really good friendships with my parents and his, because he was also a practicing alcoholic. We had three sons, and we stayed married 14 years, and it was an extremely violent, physically violent marriage, and there was an awful lot of drinking that went on with it. And I experienced blackouts from the very beginning when I was drinking. And so he would go out and party and drink. And I thought I was going to be an Al-Anon, but I didn't cut it. I drank too much. I stayed home. I stayed home and I drank. And either I would totally black out and not remember what went on, or I would know what buttons to push when he came home to make him get mad and start beating on me or doing something like that. And I knew how to do it. I mean, you know, we're so good at button pushing, and I was, you know, I really qualified well on that one. And so, like I said, I stayed married 14 years and had three sons. And I decided that, you know, life had to be a little bit different. It could have been a little bit better. We were living down in Morgan City, home of Louisiana. And had a house full of company. There was a big New Year's Eve party or something going on. And everybody got drunk. And I decided that was my time to do it. So I got in the car, and I was going to drive back to Baton Rouge. Well, first I had to call home, Daddy, you know, I cannot come home. And he said, okay. He didn't sound real happy about it. But I got in the car, and it was, you know, like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was one of these overly dramatic alcoholics. I keep saying I should have gotten an Oscar for it. But I was in the car driving, and I was gonna get on the other lane, and I was gonna run into somebody head on and kill myself. Had this all planned out. Well, then I chickened out, so I pulled over, first place I could find, and found a phone, and I called the priest that had married us, and I told him that if he didn't show up right away, I just didn't think life was worth living, and nobody would ever see me again, and it was, you know, really bad. And so he got in the car and came and got me, and brought me to my parents. My husband then brought me my 3 sons, and they stayed with us. We lived with my parents for about 3 or 4 months. They say that you cross a line somewheres along the way where you get into alcoholism. I don't know when that happened. I think it happened a lot earlier than I think. But I'm going to tell you, I was not a woman alcoholic that sipped bourbon out of a teacup behind a closed door. I drank. And most of my drinking I did at home. But I got the divorce, and I'm living with my parents, and I can't do what I want to do, and life is getting very uncomfortable. So I got myself a job, found a place to live, and took my 3 boys and moved out and found freedom. I thought, it's my turn. He did that all these years. I get to have a turn, whatever that is. But anyway, I moved out and got a place to live and took the boys with me. I'm going to talk to the women in here tonight, because I don't think, like I say, I didn't drink out of a teacup. I think there's a lot of things that go on with a woman alcoholic that we tend to neglect, that we don't talk about a lot, and we don't get to drink very long, and that is just so unfair. I had been drinking for a few years, and I did a lot of blackout drinking. I remember getting up in the mornings and going out and seeing if the car was in the driveway and if there was any blood on it or if there were any new dents in it or, you know, all of those things that happen to you when you drink in a blackout. But I didn't get to drink very long. I was divorced. I moved out. I got my own place. And it only took me 3 years to hit bottom. And I mean, I hit it with a bang. My last drunk, and I don't like to talk too much about my drinking career, because hell, y'all have all done it. You know what to do with it. It's the program that's important to me. And they told me if I didn't remember my last drunk, I hadn't had it yet. And I don't think that I will ever, ever forget it. I hope not, because it is still as vivid in my mind today as it was 40 years ago. I had one friend when I got to this stage in life. Her name was Diane, and I usually drank at home, but if I wasn't going to drink at home, I would take Diane with me because she'd make sure I got back to the house okay. Well, I got one night, I didn't have anything to drink, and I couldn't find Diane, I guess. I don't know what happened, but I decided that, you know, I was going to go out and drink. So I got in my car, and I went to this little neighborhood bar. And I walked in, I said, I'm 35 years old. I sat down at the end of the bar, and I looked down at the end of the bar, and I just felt so totally humiliated, because there was a man sitting down at the end of the bar that had worked with my dad, and I grew up with his children. He knew me very well. And he knew what I was doing there. I'm a 35-year-old single woman with maybe $2 in my pocket, and I'm out to drink. And so I got myself a drink, and a couple of minutes later, some guy came and sat down next to me, started buying me drinks. And I still, the pain that I felt that night is still with me so deep. Anyway, he told me he'd like a ride home. That's a good line. But anyway, so we got in my car and I drove him home, and he invited me in. And you know, I knew everything up here. I knew what I was doing. I don't know how low I was going to sink. I mean, it's the lengths that I was willing to go to as an alcoholic, and the degrading things that I did to myself, and the low morals, and all of the things that I was trained not to do, that I grew up, I knew better. But it's like, it's out the window. There's no control. So anyway, I go in this guy's apartment, and I can see it today. I was walking down the hall towards his bedroom, and he's right behind me. And I got stone cold sober. And I looked down at the end of the hall, and I saw a toy box. And I don't know why the toy box did it, but the toy box got me sober. I turned around and walked back out and got in my car and went home. I got up the next morning and I called my one friend, Diane, that I had left. And I told her, I said, I think I may need to find out how much this Alcoholics Anonymous cost. I might want to see about it. I was very poor. I didn't have much money in those days. So I came home from work that evening. And my oldest son, David, was standing at the back steps, and his face was just red, and he's furious. And I can't figure out what's going on. And he said, some lady keeps calling here and saying you have a drinking problem. He said, I keep hanging up. He said, she keeps calling back. He said, she's called about 10 times. So Diane evidently called to find out how much it cost so I could get in. So anyway, Jean called. She called back. And she was a real sweet Southern lady. And she was just talking up a storm to me about alcohol and how ladies drink. And I was having a hard time listening to her. So then she got into religion and started talking about being a Catholic. And then so I got into that with her. And she asked me if I thought I could go until the next day without a drink. And I said, well, of course. You know, what kind of question is that? You know, not a deal. So anyway, this was on a Friday night. Saturday morning, I can't want to say the games begin. Saturday morning, my phone rang, and it was Jean. And she wanted to talk to me about going to this noon meeting. And the kids were gone, and I was going through withdrawals. I didn't get to DTs, but I was climbing the walls. And I could hear the cars driving down the street and the fly going across the room. And so Jean calls, and she's thanking me and telling me how good things are going to be. And I thanked her, and I told her, I said, you know, I've been thinking about it. I said, and I prayed about it. And I just really, I don't think that I really need to come at this time. Maybe, you know, later or something. But so she says, honey, do you think you can go another 10 minutes without a drink? I said, I started crying. And I said, yes, I think I can do that. Well, in 10 minutes, this car barrels into my driveway. This woman gets out. She comes to my front door, opens the door, walks in. Hi, I'm Etta. Where's your coffee pot? And she's in my kitchen making coffee, and I don't know what the hell's happened. She starts telling me that she's going to be the person to take me to this first meeting, and that she really needs a cup of coffee bad, and that she's on her way back from Angola where she's been visiting her son. And I thought, I don't want to be associated with people like you. So anyway, Etta makes coffee, we drink coffee, I'm splattering coffee all over the place. So she takes me to Shoney's in Baton Rouge, and she said, honey, you need to eat something sweet. She said, when you're coming off of alcohol, you need chocolate or something. She said, it'll make you quit shaking. So she orders me this big old chocolate cake with ice cream in between the two layers. And when we left my house, she's talking, and she taps the accelerator when she drives. So all the way from my house to Shoney's, I'm ready to puke all over the front of her car, and I'm doing like, and then she brings me to Shoney's and puts a chocolate cake in front of me, and people were walking by, and they'd pat me on the shoulder. It's going to be okay. It's gonna be all right, honey. It was all AA people. It was the hangout, you know? And quite obviously, I had a big AA across my forehead that day. I really started getting kind of concerned about what I'd gotten myself into. I really wasn't sure I was an alcoholic. I thought maybe possibly I was going crazy, and I was really afraid somebody was going to find that out and take my children away. Not like I had been a very good mother, but I really wasn't sure what an alcoholic was. To start off with, it wasn't a woman. Alcoholics are men, and they sleep under bridges, and they smoke cigar butts, and that was what I knew about an alcoholic. And I had no idea that a woman, especially not a good Catholic woman like me, could become an alcoholic. But anyway, Etta puts me back in the car when I can't eat the chocolate cake, and we go to Jean's house, the lady I've been talking to. And when we walked in, she did the same thing. Opened the door, walks in. I don't even know who these people are. And God knows, drunk, you know, you don't go anywhere without your own wheels because you can't get out. So anyway, she knocks on the door and we walk on in. And there's about three or four ladies sitting in a little room. And I see one woman, she's sitting in a rocker. And she's got on a sweatshirt, and it's got big holes all in the sweatshirt, and she's rocking, and she's humming, and rocking, and humming, and I thought, that's an alcoholic. That's what a woman alcoholic looks like. It wasn't me. At any rate, we get in the car, all of us, and we tap the accelerator, and we go to the meeting. And we sat in rows like y'all are doing here tonight. And I sat on the last row. And I remember Dan was chairing the meeting. And you know, we think it doesn't show. He gets up on his toes and he looks. He said, honey, it's okay. You can sit on your hands. And I was shaking so hard I was about to fall out of the chair, and I didn't think anybody noticed that. When I left, I had two wet handprints on my rear because my hands were sweating. But I don't remember what was said. I don't remember what they talked about. All I knew was it was somewhere as I needed to be. And people were being nice to me. And they were having a meeting the next day, and they told me where it was and asked me if I wanted to go, and I agreed to do it. And so I started going to meetings. I would come home from work, and my phone would ring, and this strange voice would say, Shoney, 7 o'clock. You know, and I was scared not to be there. I didn't know what they would do to me, but I knew I better be there. So I did, you know. And I was at Shoney's at 7 o'clock. You can book it. And I went to a meeting every night. I went to a meeting every night. I missed one night in a year, but I went to a meeting every night because I guess I figured they were going to come lock me up somewhere or something. But somebody picked me up every night. And I think I was so totally insane when I got here. You know, I remember they were telling me the stuff that's in the big book, and they were telling me about open-minded, honest, and willing, and how you have to get honest if you want what this program has to offer. And, you know, bear in mind, I'm divorced, I have three kids, a high school education with one semester of engagement, and I'm not making a lot of money, and we don't have a whole lot. And so they're telling me, get one of these. It'll save your life. If you can't buy one, steal it. That's what they said. Say, go to the public library, check it out, keep it. When you can afford to buy one, buy it and go put it back. But you need a book now. You need one today to save your life. And so this one I have here, I don't guess they do it now. Can you still get deposits on Coke bottles? I got $2 worth of deposit money on the Coke bottles and got this book secondhand from a lady in the meetings. I used to buy my gas like that to go to meetings too. Had my kids picking up Coke bottles. But, you know, life got really good. It was, all of a sudden, people were nice to me. I started bathing regularly, that might have helped. But, you know, people were being nice to me. I started making friends. AA was not that big in Baton Rouge at the time. I don't think there was, there might have been seven meetings a week at that time. But we all kind of ran together. If we had the telephone on weekends, it was transferred to your house, and everybody in the program came over and brought food and spent the whole weekend at your house. So we had ample supply of people to make 12-step calls, which some of you guys in here can remember those 12-step calls. I miss those. They were so much fun. But we used to do that, and we used to get together at our houses and take these 12-step calls. And it was just so neat because I felt like I belonged, you know. All of a sudden, I was going to be a part of something. All of a sudden, people were kind of happy to see me around, and they'd call, and I'd call them. And 2 o'clock in the morning, if I can't sleep, I'll call you. It's okay, you know. But we did that. And somebody said, work the steps. Somebody said, get a sponsor. I did that. I got a sponsor. I started reading the steps in the big book, and I started going to step meetings, and I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. There's no doubt my life was unmanageable, but I started going through these steps, and I think at the time, I think God has been so good and put everything I need in front of me, but at the time, I did the best I could. Working the steps. I don't think I was real honest with my sponsor. I don't think I called her real often. But at any rate, I'd go out to coffee with these people, and they were just improving my life so much. I remember one night we were sitting at Shoney's having coffee, and they were talking about an upcoming election. And I added my 2 cents in, because all of a sudden I'm brilliant. The whole crowd went dead quiet, and somebody said, are you registered to vote? No, you can't take part in the conversation until you register to vote. I mean, they made me clean up my act. I mean, they were really following me around. So, but anyway, things like that, and it just, they had been there all my life. I never saw them. I was raised in the Catholic religion all my life. My three sisters got it. I didn't, you know. I just missed the boat on a lot of things. But anyway, I got a boyfriend. That's the other thing that's real important when you're a woman and you're single and you're new in the program. Got myself a boyfriend. He'd pick me up and take me to meetings, take me out to eat. It was really pretty nice. I hadn't been treated that nice in a long time. I tried to act nice and behave myself and do a little bit better. At any rate, I chugged along. I became the Little Miss Pollyanna AA. I started sponsoring women. I missed a home group meeting and became the GSR of my group. That's how I learned about service work. Yeah. I was real involved. I mean, I was right there in the middle of all of it, taking the telephone. Any new woman that came in needed a sponsor, come on down, you know, I'm going to save you. And this went really, really well for a while. At 5 years not drinking, I went into a suicidal depression. All of a sudden, I didn't want to be around y'all. I knew I had to. I'd go to a meeting, but I wouldn't talk to you. I'd go home. I'd go back in my bedroom and close the door. I wouldn't talk to my kids. And I had no idea what was happening. I didn't even realize at the time that I was doing this. And I had become a very people person because I had a lot of friends, you know. But anyway, somebody in the program picked up on it. There was a guy that worked for the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Council that he used to help me get people into detox. And I called him one day and I said, I need to talk to you. And he said, you couldn't have picked a worse day. I said, I need to talk to you. He said, okay. He said, meet me for coffee. So I did. I went to one of the hangouts and I got there before Bob did. And he came in and he sat down and he said, don't talk to me. I got to have coffee first. So I didn't say anything. And he got his coffee and he said, all right, what's the big deal? And I don't know what I said to him. I honestly don't remember. And God, this is the most cold, stoic person in the whole world. And I looked up and he was crying. And I thought, school's out, sister. You know, you can't be an alcoholic. You can't be a recovering alcoholic. And you're just crazy. They are going to lock you up. And he asked me, he said, can you get in your car and drive to Lee's place? This was a friend that had just opened up an outpatient facility. And I looked at him like he's nuts. I said, well, of course I can drive over there. He said, will you follow me? I said, yeah, I'll follow you. So I followed him over there, and they locked me up. The nerve. But what happened was, getting myself into this suicidal depression was a direct result, you ready, of not working the steps. I had to go back. I had to quit sponsoring people. I had to quit all my cute little service jobs that got me all that attention. And I had to get honest and learn how to work this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to find a God of my understanding. And it was not the one that I grew up with. I blew that one when I drank with the priest and found out how much they could drink. But in this insane mind of mine, I have to know what something or somebody looks like or what this figure's going to be and this God. I need to know what this God's going to look like. I have to have an image in my head. And people laugh at me today. But I'm going to tell you about this God that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. He looks exactly like George Burns. Cigar and all. Because what made sense to me was that movie, Oh God. And I can't remember what I did yesterday. I remember that line where he told John Denver, I have given you everything that you need to have a happy life. Pick it up and use it. And that was the God that I found in here. He gave me everything I could possibly want or need I just had to get off my rear end and use it and do the things that I was supposed to do. I was also told that when I was trying to work these steps, my biggest problem was my ex-husband. I couldn't get past the bitterness and the resentment towards that man. And my sponsor told me I had to work on him first, that I had to take care of that resentment before I could go any further in my fourth step. And he told me to read that story, Freedom from Bondage, in the back of the big book. And in that story, it tells you to pray for this person to have everything that you would like to have. And I learned how to pray in Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember the first night I got down on my knees and I said, God, they told me that I have to do this and I don't want to do it and I really don't mean it and I really don't want you to help the son of a bitch. That was the first night. By the end of 2 weeks, I really could wish him well. And I'm here to tell you today, he and his wife come to my house. They come watch football games and come have coffee. I don't know how that ever took place. But that story, Freedom from Bondage, really saved me. And once I got past that resentment, I was able to go ahead and do a good fourth and a fifth step. I had a real problem, and what got me into trouble when I went into that suicidal depression was I thought I had worked steps 1 through 5. When I got to 6 and 7, if you read it, I kind of thought God was going to come down and sprinkle some fairy dust on me and make all those things go away, those character defects, and you know, because it said God's going to remove them. Well, I was waiting. He didn't show up. So I had to go back and do this all over again. And I learned from that one that for me, step 6 and 7 were the first times I had to actually, and this is for me, I had to actually physically walk out those doors and behave myself. I had to change the way I treated other people. I had to change the way that I behaved. And I never thought it was that. I thought these are 6 and 7. Get down on your knees, pray for something, and it's all going to be okay, and pay attention once in a while, and it's going to get good, you know. It didn't work that way for me. I had to learn how to behave. I had to learn how to be a grown-up, which I don't think I've accomplished yet, but I'm working on it. I also went back and got very involved in service work. And I did become the GSR again and the DCM, and I held an office at Area Assembly until we moved. But for me, that was where I found the winners. And I kind of feel like I'm preaching to the choir here tonight because I bet everybody here does something. But that's where I found the people that go the extra mile in this program. And those are the people, those are the winners I wanted to be associated with. And I spent a lot of time with him, too. I was still single. Two of my children had grown and left home. One was married, one was in the Air Force. I had one left at home. And I decided I needed to quit looking for boyfriends. I decided God had given me a pretty decent life in this program, and I was happy doing the things that I was doing, and I was satisfied, and I wasn't real sure about the future or what was going to happen. But I remember I was in a bookstore with some people and some women in AA. We were buying birthday cards, and I picked up a book. And I wished I had bought it. I don't even remember the name of it. But I was flipping through this book, and a woman wrote this story about her life and how, you know, she wound up being a single parent and the struggles that she went through trying to raise her children. And she was by herself. They were all gone. And she said this prayer. And she used words I have never used before. in this context. She said, God, if you want me to stay alone for the rest of my life, please teach me how to be happy, joyous, and free. And if you want me to be with someone, please send me someone worthy of my respect. I never used those words. I wasn't real sure I'd ever look for respect. But at any rate, I remember reading that book, and I left there. And the group that went to area assembly, it's a bunch of single people. There were about 20 of us. We used to drive up to Alexandria all the time. And this guy in there, all of a sudden, the situation kind of changed with him. I don't know what happened. But all of a sudden, it was like the whole relationship changed. I had been offered a job out of town. And Wayne came by the house one day and asked me not to take it and asked me to get married. And I wasn't sure I knew how to do that. But we sat down and we talked about it. And a lot of our friends in the program got married. And when they did, they immediately became joined at the hip and the brain. Did you ever see someone like that? And I had worked so hard to find out who I was and what I was, and he had done the same, that we had some long talks about this kind of stuff, about each of us having our own space and our freedom. And we just celebrated 31 years of marriage this past October, so. We told each other we signed a 40-year contract and we can renegotiate at the end of 40 years, so. I think we may have a chance. But, I think it would be almost impossible. It is for me to. I said something in the meeting last night about talking about the spirituality of this program and what I found in it. And to me, it's just an indescribable thing. I have a very hard time. I can share what I can with the women I sponsor, but it's something that I never thought existed. Wayne and I are both very involved in AA down there. And twice a year, I didn't realize Dirk had been to my house. Twice a year, we do an open house, and we'll have 150 to 200 people. And I don't even know where they all come from, but we have them. And it's really pretty dadgum neat, because there's not a lot of socializing in AA down there where we are. And that's the AA I grew up with. You know, you go out and have coffee, you have people over to your house, you talk on the phone, you do things together, you have picnics. We got a carload of people. I think the first couple of years I sobered up and pooled money, food stamps, and cars, and took a trip to Pensacola to the beach. We thought we were flying high, you know, but we did. And we'd pile the kids in the car and take them with us. And my kids grew up in this program. I came home from work one day, and my oldest son, David, I had the phone that weekend, and they had already transferred it. And I guess David must have been about 13 or 14 at the time. And I walk in the house, and he's on the phone, and he's saying, well, do you want to quit or not? Pour it down the drain. But they grew up with this, you know? And that oldest son he's a black belt Al-Anon. I think he runs it in Tallahassee. He and his wife both. But I can never, ever be grateful enough for what this program did for my boys. When one of them cut his hand open when I was at a meeting one night, did they, two grandmothers living in the town, they called Club 12 to get Sophie to take him to the hospital. You know, they learned to love the people in this program, and these people taught them how to act. I was single. Well, the guys in the program gave the sex talk to my boys for me. I didn't know what to tell them, you know. But, it has given me things in life that I never thought possible. And it's made such wonderful people out of them. All three of my sons are grown, married, and given me more grandchildren than I care to have. That's Wayne's kids doing that to me. It's not mine. Wayne has four girls. But I mean, it's given me children that I don't deserve to have, that we have a relationship. They call me, I love it, you can tell they use me. They call me on the way home from work to help them stay awake while they're driving home. I know they do that, you know. The youngest one lives in Charlotte, and he'll say, talk to me, Mom. I said, I'm not talking politics with you because we'll argue. He said, we need to. I need to stay awake. You know, and so we'll talk while he drives home. But I have such a loving relationship with those boys and also with Wayne's girls. I had two of them call me last week. I mean, they both, I need to vent. You know, talk to us. You know, call your mother. But they don't. I'm so grateful for the things that I've gotten. I don't have time to have problems on a daily basis. Now, I'm really fortunate. We're retired. None of the kids live around where we are, so I'm not involved in their daily lives and the stuff that they have going on. But, you know, when I see the things that have happened with them and the people that they have become, and Wayne's girls are the same way. It's just we have had way more blessings than we deserve. And there's one more thing I want to touch on, and it stayed with me. When I was little, my grandfather used to walk to, for the Catholics in here, Novena on every Tuesday night. And I'd go with him every once in a while. I had to be pretty little. And I asked him one night, I said, well, what are you praying for? He never missed a week, never. And I said, Papa, I said, what is it you're praying so hard for? And he said, well, nothing right now, but it never hurts to have a few on the books. Okay? And that's what meetings are for me. I go when I need them, and I go when I don't need them. And I've managed to pile up enough of them that when I hit some tough times, they're there. And it's what saves me. And the other thing, I brought my book up here because I'm an absolute Dr. Bob fan. I love the way that he worked his program, that he kept it so simple, because a person like me, I get confused pretty easily. But I'm taking this from the big book and from Dr. Bob's story. And he talks about this. He said, I spend a great deal of time passing on what I've learned to others who want and need it badly. I do it for four reasons. A sense of duty, because it's a pleasure, because in so doing, I'm paying my debt to the man who took the time to pass it on to me, and because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. And I ask the ladies I sponsor to be sure that they read that and to read it every day and to remember it's what's going to save their life. And I said, thank you all so much for having me.